What's up, homeowners? Look what I got going. We got the backyard, we got the waterfall. You see that? And that's the sound you hear. We're in private property in the power of eminent domain again because we have socialists trying to take over New York City. And let's face it, New York City has dealt with socialism for a long time. So why are we surprised? We're not really surprised. I'm not surprised. The angle I'm taking here, it's not like I'm a voter in New York City. I'm not trying to commandeer votes. I'm not an electioneer or anything like that. I'm just a squirrely academic, and I'm interested in takings. Private property and the power of eminent domain. It gets to the very heart of what we're talking about with socialism, which includes, I would say, a lot of the flirtations with socialism that the New Deal Democrats back in the Great Depression were playing footsie with. You know, let's not beat around the bush here. What I love about Richard A. Epstein's book here, published by Harvard University Press, is that he takes such a thoughtful approach, constitutional law approach, to this issue of takings. And we've gone through the first three chapters. We're in chapter four called Takings and Torts. Takings and Torts, where he's going to make an analogy between the governmental taking of private property. That's what it is. That's what we're talking about. And torts, which is a private harm in the common law. So you're going to learn a little bit of common law. You're going to learn a little bit about private law and how there's an analogy between private law and public law. My PhD was in public law and American politics from Claremont Graduate University, which is part of the Claremont Colleges. A lot of my schooling was at, for example, Claremont McKenna College, where all of my dissertation ultimately, committee ultimately came from. Ralph Rossum and Joe Bissett, Ken Miller, Michael Uhlman. Was my mentor for over a decade, was high up in the Justice Department under Ford, had a law degree and a PhD. He was pretty high up under Reagan. He convinced Clarence Thomas to become a judge. And I feel like I had some pretty good training. I'm passing it on. So this is chapter four, Takings, Private Property, and the Power of Eminent Domain. We'd like to thank Harvard University Press for making this material available. Go out and get your copy today. Or tomorrow, or yesterday. We'd like to thank Richard A. Epstein for writing it. We're going to make a fair use, transformative reading of this material. I'm going to enjoy a cigar while we do it. And my cigar is a Penn Standard, not a paid sponsor. I'm not doing this to say that they're a paid sponsor. I'm just saying what I'm enjoying today, Wolcott. Kentucky bourbon. If you're not on U-Boob, pop into U-Boob and see what it is we're looking at. It's light enough where the sun is just going down here pretty soon. So it's light enough where I might be able to get some good commentary in here and we'll get going. Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is 30 October 2025, years after Jesus. I'm going to try to get through to Federal Tort Claims Act on page 41. I think that's a good stopping point for today. Maybe. I don't know. Here's some of the subchapter headings: benefit and loss, destruction of private property, the basis of liability, strict liability, Federal Tort Claims Act. I mean, we'll do what we can. I'm not trying to. I'm just an academic, okay? I'm just a guy. Richard Epstein starts chapter 4 by saying the prohibition against the taking of private property has ancient and powerful roots in all legal systems. Takings and torts is what the chapter is called. I'm lighting up. I got a Zippo, so it's taking longer.
You took too long. I'm going to Twitter. You took too long. I'm bored.
Well, don't let the door hit you on the way out. All right. The prohibition against the taking of private property has ancient and powerful roots in all legal systems. The early common law, for example, treated the carrying away, aspersion of chattels, and the dispossession of land as paradigmatic takings of private property. Are we supposed to just take this? Is this just what our lot in life is? I'm going to get a picture of the beautiful sunset. Oh man, this is great. Oh. Yeah, it's a beautiful sunset. Now, let me see if I can show you. Can you see that? I don't know if you could see it. Ah, crap. Probably not. Yeah, I tried. Well, anyway, the government takes itself to be able to do things that private property owners can't do. Okay, let's start there. What are we to make of that? You know, is that just one of those brute facts that you just have to deal with? Brute facts is like an epistemology term. Are you familiar with epistemology? I'm not a huge fan of Penn Standard, but it's what I have tonight. It's probably not the best to do an episode on, but the early common law, for example, treated the carrying away of chattels and dispossession of land as paradigmatic takings of private property. Cases of this sort typically must satisfy four stringent conditions that make redress straightforward. First, the property in question is equally valuable to the defendant and the plaintiff. Second, the taking by the defendant is both conscious and deliberate. Third, the taking is accomplished by the simple direct act of the defendant without any assistance or intervention by third parties or natural events. Fourth, the taking is of the entire thing, not its part. Okay. When all four of these conditions are conjoined, it is undeniable that private property has been taken under the common law. What's the significance of common law? It's private law, not just public law. It's private law. The limits of the takings principle are explored only when one asks whether the proposition that the defendant has taken the plaintiff's property remains true when any or all of these four conditions are relaxed. Suppose, for example, the defendant values the thing more than the plaintiff, or the reverse, or assume that the defendant does not retain the property but destroys it or sells it to a third party. Suppose that the taking or destruction of the thing is not deliberate but is merely negligent or even wholly accidental. Suppose, finally, that the thing is not taken in its entirety but only in part. See what he just did there? He said, you have four conditions where it's a pure taking, no questions, if those four conditions are met. If there's some kind of adulteration in one or more of the conditions, then it gets a little bit harder to figure out. The central thesis of this chapter can now be stated, Richard says. None of these variations treated alone, nor all of them in combination, falsify the proposition that A has taken private property from B, where A and B are not the same person. I added that last part. None of them treated alone, nor all of them in combination, deprive a private plaintiff of a cause of action against a private defendant. Relaxation of any of the conditions may influence the choice between theories of tort and of restitution. It may require resort to principles of strict liability. It may test the outer limits of causal theory, or it may alter the proper measure of damages. But none of these choices undercuts the basic proposition that the plaintiff is still prima facie entitled to some recovery against the defendant for property that has been taken. Isn't this exciting? The analysis of the private situation has necessary consequences for the public law. On Lockean principles, the government stands no better than the citizens it represents on whether property has been taken. So a simple test determines not the ultimate liability of the government, but whether its actions are brought within the purview of the eminent domain clause. There you go. I'm going to read that again in case you were sleeping. What you're not seeing with this whiskey is I put an ice cube in it, like it was like an hour ago already. It took me like an hour to get ready. And it melted, and I actually prefer this version right here, melted ice. Fine. Straight up, it's a bit pungent. I'm sensitive. I'm sensitive. Sorry, I'm a sensitive man. The analysis of the private situation has necessary consequences for the public law. He just gave you the common law background of torts and strict liability in private situations when there's property damage or taken property or stolen property or damaged property, etc., etc. You might hear me puffing a cigar. You might hear the Zippo going like that. That's me taking a break and letting you think about what I just said. The common law is the Anglican background, the English background of some of our private law, most of our private law. Okay? So what he's saying here is that the public law, that is law that implicates government action, the public law is analogous with certain constitutional provisions, where if you don't have this background of common law, you're going to be at a disadvantage in understanding the provision he's talking about. Here, it's the provision about private property in the Constitution. It's the takings clause, the eminent domain clause. So on Lockean principles, that's John Locke, the government stands no better than the citizens it represents on whether property has been taken. So a simple test determines not the ultimate liability of the government, but whether its actions are brought within the purview of the eminent domain clause. Would the government action be treated as a taking of private property if it had been performed by some private party? If so, there is a taking of private property, and we must examine further to determine whether compensation must be paid. If not, there is no taking of private property, and the government has necessarily rebutted the eminent domain challenge. The first order of business, therefore, is to examine the permissible permutations of the proposition A has taken the private property of B, where A and B are not identical, and I added the last part. In other words, A is not Clark Kent and B is not Superman. Where those two are identical. They refer to the same person. Okay, two different names for the same person. Benefit and loss. Suppose that A takes property from B, I'm on page 36, which he then consumes or sells to C, where these are different people. A, B, C are not identical to either of the others. A, as it is no longer possible to restore the specific property, a court must select the measure of damage payable by A to B. Where the original taking is deliberate, the plaintiff, by virtue of the waiver of tort rules, normally has an election against a private defendant between tort and restitution. Where the loss to the plaintiff exceeds the gain to the defendant, the plaintiff recovers the full extent of his loss under a tort theory. Where the gain to the defendant exceeds the loss to the plaintiff captures that gain under a restitution theory, sometimes without any allowance for the defendant's own costs. This remedial choice is presented where the benefit and loss are of roughly the same magnitude, or where they are widely different. Yet the entire debate is intelligible only because it presupposes that the original wrong for which relief is required is the taking of private property. That simple proposition and no more is all that need be established to show that the eminent domain clause is fairly implicated no matter what the remedial mix. The remedial choice between restitution and tort measures of damage becomes critical in evaluating both the public use and the just compensation components of the eminent domain clause, which I will discuss in their proper sequence. He's got footnotes here. And mostly I will not be reading the footnotes. But they are interesting, and you may want to dip into the footnotes. Get yourself a copy of this. Taking Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, Harvard University Press, 1985, 40 years ago. This is the 40th anniversary. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of this. Destruction of private property is next on page 37. The methods thus far developed provide the framework for analyzing cases in which the government has destroyed rather than taken private property. Here, of course, it is possible to make textual arguments that the verb taken should be read in opposition to the verbs damaged or destroyed on the grounds that a taking requires the government to assert, at least implicitly, the possessory interest in the property. This point could then be reinforced by noting that many state constitutions explicitly use the phrase property taken or damaged in obvious opposition to the federal language. Such a narrow reading of the eminent domain clause should be rejected. Now, as an overview of this, you should be aware that Richard wants the eminent domain to have clause to have teeth in the Constitution. No passes for the government. It's got teeth. He thinks there's incredible wisdom in this clause that we're missing out on the benefits here, because the government just gets a pass, and it gets a pass largely because of the courts. It could be corrected by voters, by the way, if they got the Congress in there that supplemented what Richard is saying here. But so that's part of what we're doing here. We're trying to convince judges, we're trying to convince voters that the eminent domain clause should have more teeth than it has had. He says such a narrow reading of the eminent domain clause should be rejected. The argument proceeds by increments. The government, like any private party, is under an obligation to compensate if it takes and incorporates the property of another into its own property, as when it renovates a courthouse with timber taken from A's land. You might be thinking, what do I care? I don't have any property. What do I care? Well, you should care, because maybe someday you will have property. What about your kids? What about your grandkids? Don't just be selfish here. I mean, just think about ideally what should happen. And in a utopian vision where property is equalized, it's basically the destruction of private property. But if you don't believe in the equalization of private property in such a way that it's destroyed, the whole concept is, there's no distinction between private and public. Well, that experiment has been run, and it didn't work out very well. See the 1900s. It's certainly not biblical. There is such a thing as private property. Okay, let's keep going. The state obligation remains when the government takes things from private parties uses them to improve public property, and then discards them upon completion of its work. And by the way, what I love about this little section here is he says the government owns property. The government is a property owner. Yeah. So much about the theory about the 99 versus the 1%. Do you know who the 1% is? The government. The government owns more property than any private individual. It owns, for example, 85% of Nevada. For example. Government owns property. We need to start talking like that. Government is a property owner. It's an interested party here. That's what Richard's trying to get you to see is you got to see the government as an actor here, akin to private individuals. It's healthier. It's healthier. You're not going to give them a pass for crappy things they do. Or you're not going to give them a pass for justified things they do, which they take advantage of. Okay, that is what happens if the state takes A's timber for scaffolding, then throws it away when the courthouse renovations are complete. What difference should it make, therefore, if the formal transfer of the thing is simply omitted when the government goes about its business, as happens if the government burns A's timber while renovating a courthouse? Page 38 at the top. Within the private law, the only difference between taking and destroying is that a claim for conversion becomes a claim for wrongful destruction. The destruction makes it very difficult to calculate the benefit obtained by the defendant, so the tort measure, harm to the plaintiff, becomes the default, by default, the sole basis for recovery. But the resemblances between the conversion of property and its destruction are powerful. Conversion involves the use of force to remove a thing from the possession of the owner, of its owner. Destruction involves the use of force to work physical changes in things that remain in the possession of the owner. Taking and destroying are close substitutes for each other, and each forms an essential part of the law of tort. I think I may do a whole thing on common law. I think that might be a good playlist for the Republican professor. So you'll get some background in tort. We've already done marriage, quite a bit on marriage, so that might be a good idea. Just as tort liability goes beyond conversion, so too does prima facie liability of the state under the eminent domain clause. Surely. Why is he calling me Shirley all of a sudden? Surely, no one would argue that the state does not take private property when it blows up a building, or that thereafter it can condemn the land without paying for the building it has destroyed. If the direct route of government takeover is blocked by the compensation requirement, the eminent domain clause can only limit government excesses by blocking the indirect of property destruction. The eminent domain clause must apply whether the government takes or destroys private property. The power of this argument was recognized in the early Supreme Court case, Pompelli versus Green Bay Company, which is decisive in principle because of the normative force of its arguments. 1871. It's 80 U.S. 166, 1871. I read that footnote. I like the way he said that. Pompelli versus Green Bay Company is decisive in principle because of the normative force of its arguments. In other words, he's saying, here's an example of a Supreme Court decision which has force because of its arguments, the quality of its arguments. Not just the authority of the court as an institution saying, hey, this is what you should believe because we have authority, but no, not that medieval way of looking at it, but rather the quality of the persuasive force is in the argument itself. There, the plaintiff sought compensation from the defendant, a private company acting under government authority, for damages occasioned when the plaintiff's land was flooded by waters backed up by a dam the defendant had constructed. The defendant argued that compensation was not required because the plaintiff had remained in possession of his land even after the flooding. That contention received a quick and pointed reply. Here's a block quote. I'm going to light my cigar again and give you the block quote. Got to get the Zippo out. Talking to a bunch of dadgum homeowners. Y'all a bunch of homeowners. Dadgum homeowners.
Not me, I live in an apartment.
Well, okay, then not you. Here's the block quote. The argument of the defendant is that there is no taking of the land within the meaning of the Constitution provision, and that the damage is a consequential result of such use of navigable stream as the government has a right to for the improvement of its navigation. It would be a very curious and unsatisfactory result if, in construing a provision of constitutional law, always understood to have been adopted for protection and security of the rights of individuals against the government. It's always the same thing with these mofos, man. I'm telling you. In the Second Amendment context, it's always the same thing, too. They try to convert the provision into a protection for the government instead of the protection of the individual. But anyway. It would be a very curious and unsatisfactory result, the court said, and again, in Pompelli versus Green Bay Company, 1871. It would be a very curious and unsatisfactory result if, in construing a provision of constitutional law, always understood to have been adopted for the protection and security of the rights of individuals as against the government, and which has received the commendation of jurists, statesmen, commentators as placing the just principles of the common law on that subject beyond the power of ordinary legislation to change or control them, it shall be held that the government refrains from the absolute conversion of real property to uses of public. It can destroy its value entirely, can inflict irreparable and permanent injury to any extent, can, in effect, subject it to total destruction without making it compensation, making any compensation, because in the narrowest sense of the word, it is not taken for public use. Such a construction, that is such a interpretation, that's what construction means, such a construction would pervert the constitutional provision into a restriction upon the rights of the citizen. Exactly the opposite. This is me. Exactly the opposite of the point of the Constitution. as those rights stood at the common law, instead of the government, and make it an authority for invasion of private right under the pretext of the public good, which had no warrant in the laws or practices of our ancestors. Amen, brother. It's like when people twist the Bible, too. I mean, the way... I have a running joke on Facebook where I say I'm gonna create an edition of the Bible that's safe for democracy. You know, the no kings thing. So I change 1st and 2nd Kings to 1st and 2nd Democracy. Change the warnings to kings and Deuteronomy 17 to warnings against democracy. Change the kingdom of God language to democracy of God. But of course, if God is still a king, you'd have to figure out that with a footnote that says God is just a Democrat who goes along with the majority. How would such a translation construe Jesus and calling of the 12 disciples? Well, it would be something like this. Jesus, if there's no kings, then Jesus himself is not a king. It's really the 12 disciples that call Jesus and ask Jesus to follow them, to incorporate Jesus into the majority, into a majority. That's all democracies care about, is a majority, right? Majorities can do whatever the hell they want with no constraint. So under the Safe for Democracy Bible, it's the 12 that go up to Jesus and say, follow me. And that's exactly what you have with some churches that pervert and invert the role of the Bible. It's where they're telling the Bible what to say, what to believe. They're telling Jesus to come follow me. You don't understand, Jesus. You need to fit into America in the 21st century. It's all about fitting in to what Hollywood wants, or, you know, fill in the blank. Whatever's trendy, what's that, whatever's in style. That's not to interpret the Bible, that's to create a Bible in your own image. That's to make the Bible safe for democracy. Well, similar things happen in constitutional law where some interpretation strategies completely invert the whole point and purpose of the whole thing. The whole purpose of the thing is to protect individual liberty, not to give government a pass on everything. As you see Democrats wanting to do in the gun control debates. You know what I mean, Ver? They do it in the eminent domain debates, too. So there's an interesting analogy here. The basis of liability, dominance of strict liability. Okay, I'm on page 39. Under the private law, the appropriate basis of liability must be determined for both conversion and destruction of property. Again, the conversion cases establish the baseline of analysis. If the private, in the private context, the defendant must restore what he has deliberately taken. Just going to let that sit for a sec. The result can hardly be different if he has taken it by accident or mistake, even if he exercised all possible care to ascertain ownership. Good footnotes, but I'm going to skip the footnotes. The defendant still has the thing, and he may not profit through his own error. Negligence is there neither here nor there. The obligation to return the property is strict, for only then can the imbalance created by the original wrong be corrected. Likewise with injunctions. The rights of the plaintiff are not limited to cases where the defendant acts with malice or negligence. So long as the threat to the plaintiff property exists, it can be repelled. If strict liability affords the proper basis for injunction against a threatened taking of property, then it governs when the lesser remedy damages is sought when harm no longer can be prevented. Given the parity between taking and destruction of property, the, on page 40 at the top, the solution to the tort question easily follows. Strict liability rules must govern both. The clause itself confirms this view because it refers to property taken, not property taken negligently or deliberately. Very good. Oh, that's good. That's good. Goes to the text of the provision in the Constitution. Yeah, the clause itself, the text of the clause itself confirms this view because it refers to property taken, not property taken negligently or deliberately. Moreover, although most government takings cases involve the infliction of deliberate losses upon private individuals, in the few cases that do not, strict liability principles are still proper. For example, in nuisance situations where the government's safety precautions, quote, were of the latest approved design and its use thereof was in the generally recognized and approved manner, unquote. That's from a court case in 1935. The central insight is not that strict liability is required, because it is in fact followed under state law in most stranger cases. It would be decisive even if the common law were otherwise, because the strict liability rule is in perfect congruence with the logic and structure of the eminent domain clause. Again, he goes to the logic and structure of the text. Textualism. Yeah. Okay. This is exciting. The major point separating negligence from strict liability concerns the treatment of the expected benefits derived from the defendant's course of conduct. A negligence rule, at least any patterned on the famous hand formula of United States versus Carroll Towing. That's, let me look at that footnote real quick. 1947, Second Circuit. States that harm to persons or property otherwise tortious shall be excused if the benefits of not preventing harm are greater than the expected costs of the harm itself. In essence, therefore, the formula allows a defendant to trade the benefits that he or society at large receives from his own conduct against the cost inflicted upon the plaintiff. The objection to this general negligence rule is that it refuses to recognize the moral necessity that the defendant, even if his conduct should not ex ante be enjoined, at the very least should be required prima facie to pay for the harm his conduct has caused to the person or property of others. The moral case behind strict liability is that the distribution of the gains and losses matters as much as the total size of the social pie. That point can be put as follows. Where expected costs exceed benefits, the negligent party must make full compensation. Where expected, where benefits exceed costs, then, by analogy to restitution arguments, the benefited defendant should make good the losses caused by taking or destroying the property. The harms inflicted upon another should be regarded to the extent that payment of compensation can do this as self-inflicted, just as the defendant has just as if the defendant had destroyed his own property. The private law point was forcefully made by Holmes, and that's Oliver Wendell Holmes in The Common Law, 1881, and that's the book I would use. I have that book. That's the book I would use to go through a common law course here on the Republican professor. Holmes was a Republican, and I'm not like exactly thrilled to say that, but it's true. So we do have to cover that at some point. The private law point was forcefully made by Holmes. Quote, one who diminishes the value of property by intentional damage knows it belongs to somebody. If he thinks it belongs to himself, he expects whatever harm he may do to come out of his own pocket. It would be odd if he were to get rid of the burden by discovering that it belonged to his neighbor. Unquote. This version of the strict liability argument has its precise parallel in eminent domain law, where the public, rather than a private defendant, must respond to the demand for compensation. The issue of whether compensation should be tendered is viewed separately from the issue of whether certain forms of primary conduct are allowed to go forward, where the benefits of the tort defendant furnish, if anything, an additional reason to compensate the plaintiff for losses sustained. Okay. Now we're at Federal Tort Claims Act, and that's on page 41. Let me see how far. I wanted to get about halfway through the chapter, and it's a little bit longer of a chapter than we're used to, so we're not going to get there because the chapter goes to page 56. So we're going to have to break this up into different sites. I think that's a natural stopping point there. What are we getting out of this here? We're getting out of this that, let's not forget, the Constitution, the text of the Constitution supplies pretty powerful ways to interpret it. It's got teeth to do what it was designed to do, protect individuals, and not to give the government a pass just because it's the government in these takings. Okay? And the way we, so where we find our footing in this discussion and this argument, we find our footing in the analogy with the common law, the private law, in tort and strict liability. Okay? Does that help? I don't know if that does. You're getting from this a, what might be a little bit hard to understand here is that you're getting respect for private property, which is probably what you're not used to. That the government itself is under an obligation to respect private property. It can't just do whatever the hell it wants. And the respect the government owes private property of individuals is roughly analogous to those of other private individuals situated when they're defendants having taken or destroyed private property. we're coming to become more sensitive about when a taking has occurred. When a taking has occurred in the first place. And not to shy away from that. And then, by analogy with the private situations in the common law, hold the government as responsible as we would a private individual for taking private property. The government owns property as well, and sometimes it acts as an abusive tormentor with no responsibility at all, almost like a sociopath. That cannot be allowed to stand under our constitutional design. It's certainly a sociopath in the socialist revolutions that we saw in the 1900s. I'm reading a novel by Ian Fleming called From Russia with Love. The novel is so much better than the book. Ian Fleming had a very firm grasp on the communist socialist threat. Because a huge part of that book is the communist background of this spy that tries to kill James Bond. He goes many chapters into this training and the culture. It's so perverse and vile and disgusting. And it's based in reality. It's based on what the communists really were like. That really happened. It's great novel. I love the novel. I've studied communism for a long time, and I think it's important to keep that in front of our minds. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is 30 October, 2025 years after Jesus. Give you one more I had to get another light. Before we stop tonight, we have a reading from Psalm 25 and Streams in the Desert, January 16th. Psalm 25 in the ESV tonight. The way you get to Psalm 25 is, if you know where Psalm 24 is, it's helpful. I just memorized what page it was on, because I don't really understand how this is set up. But, okay, here's Psalm 24. Oh, it's right before Psalm 25. Okay. I guess that makes sense. So it's Psalm 25. Teach me your path. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Make me know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. There's a lot of talk in the Psalms about waiting. And I don't know about you, but I'm always like, what are you waiting for? What are we waiting for? This waiting theme drives me nuts. Anybody have any insights? Tell me. Waiting for my Zippo to light my cigar. Verse 6, Psalm 25. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right, and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. Who is the man who fears the Lord? Him will he instruct in the way that he should choose. His soul shall abide in well-being, and his offspring shall inherit the land. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Consider my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. Consider how many are my foes, and what violent hatred they hate me. With what violent hatred they hate me. Verse 20, Psalm 25. O guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. Psalm 25, a moment of reflection in the ESV, English Standard Version. You get a view of the pool light and the waterfall. Can you see that? Can you hear it? Love that sound. It's not my house, it's my mentor, Dr. Doug Geivitz, my epistemology mentor. Check out his writings. He did his PhD under Dallas Willard at USC in religious epistemology. Wonderful. Streams in the Desert is next. Kalman Publications, Los Feliz Station, Los Angeles, California, 1925. The original non-woke edition. We're in January 16th. And there arose a great storm, Mark 4:37. Some of the storms of life come suddenly, a great sorrow, a bitter disappointment, a crushing defeat. Oh man, after that sentence, I'm going to have to light my cigar. Using the Zippo, taking a little bit longer to light. Zippos remind me of the Navy. We didn't have torches in the Navy. We had Zippos back in my day. We had Zippos, young lad. Zippos. You guys don't know how well you have it. And Penn is okay. Penn Standard is okay. It's not my favorite. My favorite is the number 3 Oliva. Should have just brought one of those out. One of these days I'll do the cigars that I like, and that'll be the end of it. No more discussion. Okay. Some come slowly. Some of the storms of life come suddenly, a great sorrow, a bitter disappointment, a crushing defeat. Some come slowly. January 16th, streams in the desert. They appear upon the ragged edges of the horizon, no larger than a man's hand, but trouble that seems so insignificant spreads until it covers the sky and overwhelms us. Yet it is in the storm that God equips us for service. When God wants an oak, he plants it on the moor, where the storms will shake it and the rains will beat it down upon it. And it is in the midnight battle with the elements that the oak wins its rugged fiber and becomes king of the forest. Damn. When God wants to make a man, he puts him into some storm. The history of manhood is always rough and rugged. No man is made until he has been out into the surge of the storm and found the sublime fulfillment of the prayer, O God, take me, break me, make me. Ah, man, I'm going to have to take a break after reading that. Damn. I've been to sea. I've been to sea. I've been over the sea in the air. Actually, I think that can be scarier, much scarier. In a storm. I was a naval air crewman. I deployed on special operations. Multiple platforms. A Frenchman has painted a picture of universal genius. There stands orators, philosophers, and martyrs, all who have achieved preeminence in any phase of life. The remarkable fact about this picture is this: every man who is preeminent for his ability was first preeminent for suffering. In the foreground stands that figure of the man who was denied the promised land, Moses. Beside him is another, feeling his way, blind, Homer. Milton is there, blind and broken-hearted. Now comes the form of one who towers above them all. What is his characteristic? His face is marred more than any man's. The artist might have written under that great picture, the storm. I think he's talking about Jesus there. The beauties of nature come after the storm. The rugged beauty of the mountain is born in a storm, and the heroes of life are the storm-swept and the battle-scarred. You have been in the storms and swept by the blasts, page 19 at the top. Have they left you broken, weary, beaten in the valley, or have they lifted you to the sunlit summits of a richer, deeper, more abiding manhood and womanhood? Have they left you with more sympathy with the wind, with the storm swept and the battle scarred? The wind that blows can never kill the tree that God plants. It bloweth east, it bloweth west, the tender leaves have little rest. But any wind that blows is best. The tree that God plants strikes deeper root, grows higher still, spreads greater boughs for God's goodwill, meets all its wants. There is no storm hath power to blast the tree God knows. No thunderbolt, nor beating rain, nor lightning flash, nor hurricane, when they are spent, it doth remain the tree God knows. Through every tempest standeth fast, and from its first day to its last, still fairer grows. Streams in the Desert, January 16th. A moment of reflection. When you hear concerns about so-called Christian nationalism, let me give you an interpretive principle here. There are people that think the government can do whatever the hell it wants when they're in charge. That's what they're worried about, is you taking that away. The Christian tradition provides the greatest check and limitation of the government of any system in the history of mankind. That's what socialists are afraid of. Because in their religion, government growth just is God, just is the religion, no matter what else they say. That's what we're fighting against here on the Republican Professor podcast. We've been taking a look again at Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain by Richard A. Epstein, published by Harvard University Press, 1985, 40 years ago. It's the 40th anniversary. Go out and get yourself a copy of this book, either used or new. Support your local bookseller. Don't just get it on Amazon. Okay, come on. Keep your money in the community if you can. Support these local book dealers. Get your copy today. Get a physical book, for God's sake. Follow along. Read a book. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. I also have a bachelor's degree. We'll see you later.